Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Today on the program, we'll hear from Governor-elect Mark Gordon as he prepares for office.
It is a very, very busy time.
We will go to Cheyenne for a story about how trauma impacts sexual violence investigations.
The trauma of that means that I just actually do not have that memory.
Wyoming is testing out new technology, a digital driver's license. But not everyone is excited about it.
Digital driver's licenses really feel like a solution in search of a problem.
Join us for these stories and much more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. 16 years ago, the Cheyenne Police Department received a report that a Catholic bishop had sexually abused a teenage boy in the 1970s. But the lead detective said there was no evidence, and the DA closed the case. Earlier this year, Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reported that case was reopened, and that multiple victims have come forward. Now, she takes a closer look at the ongoing investigation and how the Cheyenne PD's attitude towards sexual abuse has changed.
The 2002 investigation of former Catholic Bishop Joseph Hart didn't lead to prosecution. His innocence or guilt was not determined, but a press release from law enforcement made it sound like they knew for sure Hart had done no wrong. It recommended no further action and the case be closed. Jeff Schulz was the lead detective on the case. He's no longer a police officer and referred me to the Cheyenne PD for comment. The victim says there's lots to learn from what happened in 2002.
The first investigation was so horribly botched.
Marty, the victim, grew up in Cheyenne. After high school, he left Wyoming and never came back. He now runs his own business in New York City. To protect his privacy, I'm using a version of his middle name. Marty says it felt like Detective Jeff Schulz started the investigation with his mind made up.
His opening introduction was, you know, you realize what you're saying is that this pillar of the community is basically a monster and that there's nobody else saying any of this. So why is it that you're coming forward?
Marty says it felt like Schulz didn't want to hear what he had to say.
This is somebody who's cross-examining me or probing in an accusatory way for gaps in my recollection.
During that interview, Marty told Schulz that when he was 12 years old, his dad took off. His mom was left alone with four kids to support. Seeing a family in need, the Catholic diocese gave his mom a job. Marty and his siblings went to Catholic school for free. Marty kept quiet when the abuse started because he didn't want to put his family in jeopardy. When Schulz asked what month his dad left, Marty felt nervous and embarrassed because he couldn't remember.
To be critiqued during this line of questioning for those failures, it really shattered my confidence in what I was saying.
So he stopped taking calls from Schulz and let the idea of holding Joseph Hart accountable drift away. Fast forward 16 years to a moment when both clergy and cops are under scrutiny for sweeping sexual abuse under the rug. To help right those wrongs, Catholic leaders in Wyoming urged the Cheyenne PD to take a second look at Marty's case. The department reopened the case this summer. Marty vividly remembers his first conversation with Sergeant Joel Hickerson.
I was very blunt in my recounting the failures of the past and telling him that I did not have any expectation that his investigation was going to go much better. And his response was remarkable. And he said, well, the Cheyenne Police Department has come a long way.
Hickerson has been with the Cheyenne PD for 11 years. He started on patrol and is now the head detective for persons crimes.
Historically, throughout America, we had issues where not believing our victims and victim blaming was part and parcel to our belief system or our views. Over the last 10 to 15 years, that's really changed on a national level, and Cheyenne has followed that.
This new approach to policing focuses on one central concept. Officers need to start by believing victims.
If they were anxious and worried that they've got a cynical jerk officer, it's going to create issues. If that individual is a victim is under stress and they're feeling judged, either they're going to close down or they're going to be so stressed out about that contact, they're going to forget those details.
Hickerson says when officers are open and listen, they gather stronger evidence. But sometimes there are details victims just can't recall.
And we need to understand that the mind, especially in times of trauma, basically takes snapshots of situations.
It's a coping mechanism, Hickerson says. We can only handle so many vivid, painful memories. For example, Marty remembers the details of the abuse, but he can't remember the exact month his dad abandoned the family.
Because I was a 12-year-old, and the trauma of that means that I just actually do not have that memory.
But it's a detail that's important to the investigation. It helps establish a timeline and explains how his family's reliance on the Catholic Church made him vulnerable to abuse. Marty says this time, instead of facing skepticism, the Cheyenne PD is working with him to put the pieces together.
The detective told me he was going to get records from the military to find out information about my father that I didn't know. So the scope of what he was telling me he was going to do was shocking, actually. I mean, it was really thorough.
Tara Muir is the policy director for the Cheyenne Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She applauds the efforts of the Cheyenne PD to seek out training and follow best practices.
It'd be great to have it implemented statewide within Wyoming.
Right now, it's up to each agency to prioritize sexual violence training. Muir says it's hit or miss whether that happens. That means Marty's experience in 2002 is still a possibility.
Which is heartbreaking because it does feel like a crapshoot for victims.
In a future story, I'll take a closer look at gaps in sexual violence training and efforts to get more officers to start by believing. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Earlier this month, the Jesuit Order of the Catholic Church released a list of priests who have credible accusations of sexual abuse against them. Two of the priests, Paul Pilgrim and Anthony Short, served at St. Stephen's Mission on the Wind River Reservation in the 1970s and 80s. Until 1939, St. Stephen's was an Indian boarding school, and after that, a day school. But the news of the priest abuse is not a surprise to many tribal members. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spoke with 71-year-old Northern Arapaho tribal member Ernie Whiteman and his daughter Missy about the Catholic Church's role on the Wind River Reservation.
Ernie Whiteman attended St. Stephen's School in the early 1960s before the two priests, Pilgrim and Short, served there. Whiteman says he never experienced sexual abuse there, but the regimented lifestyle was a shock to him because he'd only attended white public schools before that.
I realized that in order to survive in that environment, I had to compromise. I had to do things to survive. I became an altar boy. One of the old style of altar boys that spoke Latin. They don't do that anymore. The classes were co-ed, but during the day, when we had recess or lunch, you know, you were well aware of that, that you did not go onto the girls' side and the girls did not go onto the boys' side, or you would be punished. We called it the Board of Education because if you were punished, you were usually sent to the office of the principal, who was one of the priests, and you were punished by the priest by a spanking. And what they had was a big board, depending on how the priest felt that day, would determine how much swats you got. They would bend you over and swat you with this big board. Actually, it was a board, and would inflict pain on the kids that committed whatever crime the church thought you were committing to be punished that severely. I had grandparents and parents that went to the same school system before I did. And it was much more severe in the sense that there was much more abuse that existed openly. And so my parents grew up in a generation where the church was successful in that they didn't speak the language anymore. Even though they knew the language, my parents would not speak the language in front of us, in front of their children.
You know, now that we have these names of priests starting to come out, is it something that you think was happening at St. Stephen's, that there could have been sexual abuse by priests there?
Oh, of course, of course. And I won't mention any names because names aren't out, but I know I'm aware of one priest for sure. You know, the priest is gone now. He's deceased. But because there was nobody to go to, there was nobody to talk to about this, there was no support. Where were they going to go? If you were abused by a priest when you were a child and you're suddenly 17 years old and this is like in 1970, who are you going to talk to? Who are you going to go to? Who's going to listen?
The other part about that is that because pretty much an entire reservation that was Christianized or Catholicized, there was always a divide and conquer mentality that happened within these schools, these education systems, that if you are a good Catholic, if you're a good Christian, then you're on the good side, you know, you're going to go to heaven and all of these great things. But if you speak out or rebelling against that system, then you're the devil, you're bad, you're going to go to hell. But the other part of that too is that if something did happen to you and your family does know, or relatives, they may not believe you because they've been so brainwashed. You know, to them, you know, these priests were like gods because they had basically stripped them from their culture, their language, their mm-hmm. religion, and had brought in this completely different belief system.
One of the things I think that we have to be very sensitive and be aware of is the victim, those that have been affected, those that are still being affected today, rather than sensationalize and giving the church more power, so to speak.
Yeah, I am working currently with the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition on the Healing Voices series. It is a series of short videos that is about healing, but it's also about documenting our elders' stories of survival through boarding school experience. And so when we interview our elders, we make sure that there is protocol that's followed. We make sure that they are not sharing for the first time. We make sure that our questions are pretty open-ended and that we are transparent about the process. We visited Turtle Mountain. That was our first community. The second community was Alaska. And then the third community was the Wind River Reservation, which is my community. When somebody tells their story, we don't leave them in a place where they're re-traumatized. We do have a counselor, we have medicine people on site that can help them. From what I've seen with our Healing Voices mm-hmm. series, our youth, our young ones are the ones that are really looking at this issue from a different perspective. Because, you know, we talk about intergenerational trauma and how it kind of seeps through each generation. But again, we have to also remember that each generation heals.
Ernie Whiteman is a retired professor of Native American history. Missy Whiteman says the Healing Voices film series will be available next year to Native researchers and others. An edited version for the general public will be available then as well. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, stories about digital driver's licenses and how the state is trying to help fight against high towing charges. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. What do driving and buying a six-pack of beer have in common? Well, you usually need to have your license. But what if you could use your smartphone for that? 4 states are testing out digital driver's licenses. As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, 2 are right here in the Mountain West, Colorado and Wyoming.
A visit to your local Department of Motor Vehicles to renew your license isn't most people's idea of a good time. Bart Simpson didn't have much fun when he was there with his Aunt Patty and Selma.
Some days, we don't let the line move at all. We call those weekdays.
He might want to come to Wyoming, where driver's licenses might be getting a shiny makeover.
I think in general, we like to try to be on the cutting edge of things.
That's Renee Krawick. She works for the Wyoming Department of Transportation, and she's project manager for the state's digital driver's license pilot program. They've wrapped up phase 1. A group of state employees acted as guinea pigs, including Krawick.
I actually drove my pickup truck with my long camper behind it. So I sat in the driver's seat, and they pulled up behind me, came to the window. They were stopping me for a cracked windshield.
Okay, so Krawick wasn't really getting pulled over. This was all part of the script, and the officer was playing along, too. He asked her for her driver's license, and she said she'd prefer to use the one on her smartphone. The program is set up so the driver doesn't have to give the officer their device. So instead, she says,
the law enforcement officer handed me a card that had a QR code on it.
A QR code works like a barcode, but instead of needing a scanner, you simply take a photo of it with your phone.
I initiated the application on my smartphone, which then turned on my camera so that I could scan that QR code. And then it prompted me to agree that I was providing my information to law enforcement. I agreed to that, and then it pushed the information from my credential to the trooper's vehicle.
The idea of the digital license is just as a backup, says Wyoming Highway Patrol Captain Carl Germain. Most people have their licenses with them, but not always.
They had to run out of the house quick. Maybe they're late for work, they're on their lunch break.
But convenience for forgetful people probably isn't why law enforcement is interested in the program. Teenagers, you might want to pay attention to this part. Germain says it could cut down on the number of fake IDs they run into.
There's always going to be a push to make those IDs better. In my career, I've seen some really bad ones that you can look at it and within a moment's glance, you can say this is not a state-issued or nationally-issued ID. This is a phony, a fake, a fraud.
But other times, he says it's harder to tell, even for law enforcement. Germain says it would be more difficult to fake a digital version than a physical one. But Ched Marlowe says not true. He's an attorney for the ACLU and specializes in surveillance, privacy, and technology issues.
With the plastic driver's license, you need to go out, you need to get a printer. A lot of times it has to have hologram technology or the ability to kind of print pictures on that see-through plastic. You know, you've got to invest thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Marlowe says it could actually be easier to create a fake digital driver's license since hackers could make a copycat program. But he's skeptical, period, of the value in states moving towards a digital option.
Digital driver's licenses really feel like a solution in search of a problem.
A big concern for Marlowe has to do with privacy. He says unlike a plastic card that has finite real estate, something like a digital driver's license could store an unlimited amount of data, like your business address or phone numbers. He says that could make it tempting to add more and more information, and that's a problem.
Unless you have very, very high security standards on that, like end-to-end encryption, that information is susceptible to being hacked.
These types of concerns are something that Wyoming's Department of Transportation says it will work on in its phase 2 of the pilot program. Along with Wyoming and Colorado, Delaware and Maryland are also taking part in the project. No timeline yet on when or if digital IDs will become available to all drivers, so for the time being, keep those licenses in your back pocket. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Can you imagine paying a tow bill of 6 figures? In an effort to stop this type of gouging, the Wyoming Highway Patrol has appointed a tow coordinator based in Cody. Penny Preston reports he's working to make a change statewide.
If you're stuck in deep snow and temperatures are freezing, you'd give almost anything to be rescued by a tow. Many of Wyoming's tow operators work hard to recover vehicles all year around, and they treat motorists fairly. But some have charged alarming amounts to tow stranded vehicles. Rodney Myers is the state's new tow recovery program coordinator for the Wyoming Highway Patrol.
The biggest tow bill that I've seen is $170,000.
That was for a tractor trailer tow, but Myers says he's seen a lot of high charges.
A 16-mile tow for a vehicle, and it was just over $800.
Myers is contacting tow companies to discuss such extreme charges as he hears about them.
Part of my job is to review the fee schedules that they provide the Wyoming Highway Patrol and make sure that they are consistent and fair, and then also look at the invoice that they provide the client and match that up with the fee schedule to make sure that what they are charged is in line with what they said they're going to charge.
Myers says although Colorado and Utah set tow fees, Wyoming does not control how much a tow operator charges. Dave Balling is a farmer's insurance agent in Cody. He says although insurance companies often foot the bill for a tow,
we really can't dictate the cost of what a tow may be. We can attempt to have a conversation with the provider to see if they'll reduce a charge. Typically, those conversations don't seem to go that well.
Balling says high tow charges drive up auto insurance costs.
Whenever that cost of a tow becomes unusually high, that affects really premiums for everybody, because if we're having to pay more for these tow bills, then we're going to have to charge more for the insurance.
Myers has been in the state's new position for 2 months. He says he's handled 20 complaints. Has he had any success?
Yeah, and I've actually had people email me and call me and say thank you for getting involved.
In Wyoming, industry representatives deal with complaints through a dispute resolution committee.
Tow and recovery owners, myself, somebody from the insurance industry, someone from the trucking industry, and someone from the Attorney General's office.
If a tow company refuses to work with the state on fair charges, there is one possible remedy. If a motorist asks a patrolman to call for a tow, the officer goes through a rotation of operators in the area and can cut out an unfair operator.
Statutorily, we have the ability to have our own rotation.
Myers says most towing companies are happy about dealing with him in his new position.
Typically, they're open to it. Now they're just dealing with one person and one person's requirements instead of multiple different division lieutenants.
But tow companies have financial challenges too. Owner of E&F Towing in Casper, Rhonda Zimmerman.
Trucks cost anywhere from $150,000 to sometimes over $1 million for some of those bigger rigs. Our insurance is really high on those vehicles, obviously. It costs a lot just to train our guys. A new driver probably goes through $10,000, $15,000 worth of training before we even put him out on the road.
Zimmerman says maintenance is another high cost for a business that has to recoup those costs over slow and busy seasons. She points out another cost factor most of us don't think about.
Uninsured and underinsured motorists. And so an awful lot of the accidents and stuff we pick up, we actually don't really get paid for. Some of those people just don't have money and they abandon their vehicles in our yard.
But Zimmerman welcomes Myers' ongoing efforts to work with the towing industry and create some stability across the state. Myers says the Towing Advisory Board will soon be reviewing state policies.
Toward the end of January or beginning of February, the Wyoming Highway Patrol is going to be teaming up with the Towing Advisory Board and the Dispute Resolution Committee and going over the proposed changes with the towing industry.
But there are occasions where someone has to deal with the towing company by themselves. Farmers insurance agent Dave Balling says you might want to ask the tow company how much they will charge. Tell them you'll call them back, then call another company to see if you can get a better deal. In other words, shop around. And tow company owner Rhonda Zimmerman says you might want to get past the shock of the accident before you deal with possible tow bill shock.
We realize that we probably meet most of our customers on the worst day of their life or close to it. The more communication we can get between ourselves and the customers, if they don't understand or they don't agree with the charge, it's good for us and it's good for them. Most of us are very willing to work with you if you just call us and talk.
If people want to reach out to the tow recovery program, they simply need to contact the Highway Patrol. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Penny Preston in Cody.
Coming up, a story on wind energy and a conversation with Governor-elect Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's next governor, Mark Gordon, has been holed up trying to hire a staff while also trying to get prepared for the legislative session. Took a few minutes to tell us what he's been up to since the election.
Unbelievably busy, really right from the day after the general election till now, interviewing, trying to get a sense of what the cabinet's going to look like, who's available, who's retiring, standing up the processes to take time on those that really we need to take time on, like Pat Terrell, who as state engineer is retiring, and that's, you know, that's a daunting challenge to make sure that we have the right kinds of people there.
As you look at your staff, is there a thought process that I want X amount of people with experience on some of these issues and that are in state government now versus some outsiders you're bringing in?
Yes. I think we want to make sure that we have a very solid fiscal team going forward. You know, one of the things I really hope we can accomplish is making sure that we have a stable fiscal future. And that's kind of a little bit longer term. And then how do we get from here to there with all the volatility we have in our public markets, in our oil and gas markets, and coal? And so we've really wanted to make sure we have a mix of old hands and bright people to work on that fiscal picture. So we're really trying to do a little bit of a mix like that. There will be some changes in larger agencies. And again, we're taking a pretty measured look at how we want to do that to really stand up a coherent program going forward.
I had a chance to talk to Governor Mead a couple of weeks ago when he presented his budget, and he did mention that he just briefly, I guess, shared it with you or at least talked to you about it a little bit. I was curious your thoughts on it.
His overall budget, I think, is very good. He was kind to say that he had tried to leave a bit of room in there for me to make some adjustments. I'm a little more cautious. Of course, he wrote the budget after the October Craig report, which was pretty optimistic. I think the base number for oil anticipated at that time was $60. We're significantly below that now. The stock market has taken a little bit of a ride. None of those are terribly concerning to me. They're cautionary, but they're not terribly concerning because this time of year, you know, there's often a lot of volatility, and not a lot gets done over the Christmas season. But I do think that means I'm going to be pretty measured in how, how many of these additions that we're going to really want to, you know, sort of up over time. I note that, you know, a couple of things that he's talked about here I feel very strongly about. We have phenomenal employees in the state of Wyoming, and I do think that as we think about our future, we don't want to see government expand, and we don't want to see it get more expensive, but we do want to see it get more productive. So I think there is a piece that we have to solve beyond just salaries. And that's my long-winded way, Bob, of saying I think it, you know, we've got some good people that deserve to have some raises. And so I think that was appropriate of him. I also, this government emergency operations account, considering the Roosevelt fire and the other fires we had, I think those are also very important for the future.
He was also talking a lot about the education fund, and I know we've talked about this in the past, on making sure that we start identifying a source of income. What's your thoughts on that, and maybe where would you like to go on that?
I think education, as we talked about, is absolutely critical to the state's future. I think it's a centerpiece of our economic diversification platform. You know, when I look at it, Bob, I think I'm very anxious to get into that discussion and see if there are ways that we can find a long-term solution that brings some continuity and some a path towards the future that we aren't just going to be sort of swinging between we don't have enough money, we need to spend more, and we'll wait for the next year's capital gains.
Outside of money, what do you want to do this session?
Well, I think, Bob, you know, obviously I think Wyoming can be a leader in solving this whole issue of energy. You know, we have energy really across the spectrum. And how do we balance that going forward so that we do both protect the environment? We lead the way in carbon capture and sequestration. We allow for the boon of alternatives and do it in a way that we still have a place that we recognize that when we drive across the country is this gorgeous place with fabulous vistas. I also think, Bob, that when we talk about water, that's going to be one of my biggest concerns, how we make sure that Wyoming's water is protected. And I think building a more robust education system. All of these things are a little bit related to money, but a lot of those are really about building a Wyoming that we recognize and the one we grew up in that we were optimistic about.
Governor-elect Mark Gordon, we do wish you well. Thank you for taking time to visit with us, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Seven states have wind energy projects underway that will double their capacities, the total amount of electricity that could be generated by wind. Wyoming, the largest coal-producing state, is among them. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports the surge comes after a decade of almost no growth in the state.
On a vast swath of prairie lined with 79 wind turbines, new blades are being delivered on the backs of 18-wheelers. Lane Anderson navigates the snow-packed service roads. He oversees all wind operations at Rocky Mountain Power, part of PacifiCorp. He parks under a massive turbine.
We're at 7 Mile 409. This is our first test turbine for repowering.
This whole wind farm will be repowered, where new equipment allows the same turbines to produce more energy. New cells, hubs, and blades lying around the site will soon increase production by 20%. It's not the company's only project, either. Rocky Mountain Power is developing 4 new wind farms in Wyoming to be finished by 2021. Anderson points out one new site in the distance. It takes a second to make out the white sticks.
Our Dunlap wind site is over there in the distance. Over there at Dunlap, TB1 and TB2 will be on the north and south side of that wind plant, and Ecola will be right in between these.
With these 4 projects, plus 3 more from other entities, they will add more than double the state's existing wind energy capacity. 6 other states are also on pace to double capacity, including Arkansas, New Mexico, and Maryland. That's according to the American Wind Energy Association. This is just the latest push of what's been an upward trend in the past few decades for wind. In 2009, wind was less than 1% of total generation across the U.S. Now it's 5 times that. Robert McCullough leads an energy consulting firm. He says the reason for all this growth is low costs.
It's much easier to buy power on the open market than maintain an elderly coal unit. And we're seeing that all over the United States.
A report from Lazard, a financial advisory firm, shows the cost of producing wind has gone down by nearly 70% in 9 years, sitting at prices dramatically below coal. Low prices are pushed even lower thanks to a federal tax credit that's set to end by 2020. Uday Varavadajan is a principal at Rocky Mountain Institute, a nonprofit focused on clean energy.
There are a lot of other states that are trying to figure out a way to put as much wind in the ground as they can.
With more and more demand from states with renewable standards and declining costs, he says it's hard for states like Wyoming to avoid new projects.
The question is, do you want to take that opportunity or not? And if you don't, it's getting harder and harder to say that you don't want to take that money from the people who want to buy your wind.
Wyoming hasn't been eager to embrace wind. If you live here, you know it's windy. The state has the 7th highest wind capacity potential, but it sits at 15th in installed capacity, according to the Department of Energy. And until this surge, growth has been stagnant. One wind developer says it's not easy to do business in the state. Paul Martin of Intermountain Wind says that's due to lack of transmission, public opposition, long permitting times, and a tax on wind, which only one other state has. Varavadajan explains the challenge.
I think Wyoming, more so than many of the states surrounding it, has not necessarily been a friendly place for wind to be developed.
Gillette Senator Michael Von Flatern says he has seen a lack of support at the state level. That's because it's felt like wind energy is supplanting other state industries, like coal. But with such good prices and coal on the decline, legislators have to figure it out.
You know, our customers demand it. We got to comply in some manner.
We can't stick our head in the sand and try to say you'll take coal or you'll take nothing.
With less money coming from coal revenues, a group of legislators is motivated to pull more income out of wind. Lander Senator Kale Case is one of them.
We need to have a tax structure that matches the extreme long-term impacts on our viewsheds and the environment, the wildlife, everything.
Impacts like noise pollution, interrupting the view, and threats to birds and bats. Case says now is the time to raise Wyoming's wind tax. Instead of $1 per megawatt hour, $5. He says some legislators support it to improve regulation, while others do it because they just don't like wind. That's not him. Back at the Seven Mile Hill Wind Farm, Lane Anderson and Rocky Mountain Power do see Wyoming as a home to world-class wind, and that's not going away.
I believe the renewable resources will be moving into Wyoming a little more readily in the years to come.
The bill to raise the wind tax is expected to come in January's legislative session. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Kids from rural communities still have a hard time getting in to see the dentist, but that's especially true if you're dealing with the Wind River Reservation. Lack of reliable transportation and long distances into town can make it hard to get in for a checkup. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner got a tour of what could be a remedy to the situation, a dentist office on wheels.
Today, the older model Winnebago is parked at an RV park, getting more equipment to help outfit it as a mobile dentist unit. The mobile home is large and white, with pictures of smiling children on the sides. My tour guide is Grant Christensen, the dental clinic supervisor for Wind River Family and Community Health.
This is a panoramic x-ray machine here for doing those x-rays.
Yeah, the x-ray's right next to the passenger seat.
Hopefully no passenger sitting there with x-rays.
The idea is to drive to tribal schools and community centers to help provide preemptive care for children on the reservation, especially since the reservation does not have fluoride in the drinking water due to lack of a tax base and poverty.
We have a lot of need on this reservation. Indian children nationwide, but particularly on this reservation, have really bad teeth. And it impacts their lives in many ways.
If kids don't get checkups and cleanings early on in life, dental issues can follow them for the rest of their lives.
You know, children miss more school because of tooth problems than from any other single factor.
For as long as anyone can remember, the federal government has run the health clinics on Wind River. There was only one dentist, and he didn't offer appointments every day of the week. 3 years ago, the Arapaho tribe took control of the Indian Health Service clinic, and now they're running it themselves.
The dental program, when we first inherited it from the Indian Health Service, it was mainly a fill and pull program, either fill your teeth or pull them.
Richard Brannon directed the old federally run clinic for years. That's why the Northern Arapaho Business Council asked him to be the CEO of the Wind River Health Center. Under his leadership, the clinic has grown. The center has hired two pediatric dentists, a general dentist, and an orthodontist. It went from a $3.3 million facility to a projected $25 million operation in 2018.
But unfortunately, healthcare is all about money.
The clinic also provides rides to people unable to find a lift to their appointments.
The mobile dental clinic has been a dream for many, many years.
A dream to provide preemptive dental care for children. He says working on teeth early in childhood is more cost-effective and less painful in the long run.
Our belief is if we get to the problem when they're young, then they can have better lives as they grow older.
Dental hygienist Holly Daverin works at the Arapaho Clinic. Daverin says soon she'll begin traveling around the reservation in the Winnebago doing checkups with the newly hired orthodontist.
I could use it for sealants and fluoride. I could potentially use it for cleanings.
CEO Richard Brannon says he is excited about the many opportunities ahead for tribal health care.
Well, our belief is that everybody should have a beautiful smile.
The mobile dentist will be rolling out to a parking lot near you January 2019. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Coming Coming up, chronic wasting disease has been found in Teton County, and the longtime president of Knowles is retiring. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Chronic wasting disease is a contagious brain disease affecting deer, elk, and moose that usually leads to death. In November, it was in Teton County for the first time. It's been present in other parts of Wyoming for a while. Some biologists and wildlife managers are afraid the infectious disease will transmit to elk, especially feed ground elk, with dire consequences. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports from one of the most famous feed grounds, the National Elk Refuge.
It's a snowy and foggy morning in Jackson Hole. Brian Glassbell, the manager of the National Elk Refuge, walks toward a green trash can.
So you can see we have a few little instructions for people and no heads.
The easiest way to test for chronic wasting disease, or CWD, is to sample the animal's lymph nodes, which are located on the neck. Glassbell called for a mandatory CWD testing of all harvested elk on the refuge right after the first mule deer in Teton County tested positive for the disease this November. As of this date, no elk has tested positive, but Glassbell says the fear that CWD will cause a decline in the elk population is real.
Creating these really dense concentrations seasonally of elk literally creates a breeding ground for things like brucellosis and now chronic wasting disease.
Elk are a huge part of Wyoming's economy in terms of hunting and wildlife viewing. According to a recent study, big game hunting, of which elk hunting is the most popular, contributes about $303 million to the state's economy. Nathan Galloway is a wildlife disease ecologist for the National Park Service. He says it's not known with absolute certainty whether CWD will cause population declines in elk, as it has with deer. But
we're also not certain that it won't cause declines. So in the Laramie Mountain population, it seems to have never reached those high levels that have really negatively impacted the population.
Currently, the Laramie Peak elk herd is free roaming and has the highest chronic wasting disease infection rate in Wyoming at an average of 6.4%. Cy Gilliland, the vice president of the Wyoming Outfitter Association, says that herd tends to congregate in high densities, but the infection rate really isn't that high. So, he says, feed grounds are a non-factor.
So the whole bias, we're somehow going to lower the infection rate of CWD amongst elk, is, in my opinion, is false. Eliminating feed grounds isn't going to do a darn thing.
Gilliland adds that CWD is much more common in deer than elk. Galloway says it's true, CWD is so far more deadly in deer, but it's possible it moves slower in elk. He says, take a look at the Rocky Mountain elk herd in Colorado, which is at an infection rate of 13%.
This high level of disease that we observed in Rocky was after several decades of disease being present there, over 25 years.
CWD is an infectious disease, which usually spreads more rapidly in dense populations. That's why the environmental groups and a former National Elk Refuge employee are calling for the National Elk Refuge and the 22 state-owned feed grounds to stop supplemental feeding.
In Rocky Mountain National Park, those animals aren't fed. They're not artificially crowded. On feed grounds, I'm just almost certain that that infection rate will be higher.
That's Bruce Smith. He worked at the National Elk Refuge for 22 years as a senior biologist. He says the refuge and the state continued supplemental feeding because it became cultural and was not about good management.
More elk, some perceive, means more economic benefit for businesses, outfitters, and some of the general public.
Brian Nesvik, the chief game warden of Wyoming Game and Fish, doesn't deny it's one of the reasons feed grounds have been kept around.
We have a responsibility, too, to try to provide an elk resource that we otherwise wouldn't be able to provide without supplemental feed.
And he doesn't deny that CWD is worrisome. And this is the problem. No one knows exactly how CWD functions or what to do about it. There's no doubt it's dangerous for cervid populations like deer, moose, and elk, but there seems to be no clear solution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Gadelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The longtime president of the National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS, is stepping down this month. John Ganz actually started with the organization in 1979 and became its president in the early 90s and oversaw some tremendous growth since then. Ganz has been named a White House Champion for Change and has received a number of state and community awards. He joins us to discuss NOLS and the outdoors. One of the things that you must be very proud of is obviously NOLS was a lot of places when you came on board back in the late 70s, but to see it expand and see the popularity not only in this country but around the world, how gratifying has that been?
Just phenomenal. And one of my great joys is visiting other locations and seeing the NOLS programs there. And inevitably, they still have a certain core DNA of NOLS. But they also all have a certain flair that localizes it and makes it appropriate to the country and the culture.
Yeah, one of the things we hear so much about, and you know this, probably hearing reports in our state that maybe youngsters aren't interested in the outdoors and aren't interested in hunting and fishing. But it seems to me that you're seeing a different type of thing happening. What's the difference? Why are you seeing growth where maybe some of these other people are not?
Well, I think there's an element of both, Bob. Namely, society has gotten more urban, and students and potential students are more attached to their devices and used to being basically connected all the time. And so I think reaching many of those students is a bigger challenge, and making them realize the relevance and the value is a bigger challenge. But once they're reached and once they arrive and go out in the mountains, the power of the mountains and the power of the disconnected experience is probably greater than it ever was before.
What would you recommend to others who are in a similar field as you are to maybe up that interest?
Well, certainly for us, one of the approaches has been to realize the many different aspects you learn from in an outdoor experience. So certainly there are the outdoor skills. But we find that for reaching parents and reaching others, the emphasis on leadership education, the emphasis on wilderness first aid and first aid education, and the emphasis on learning skills and expedition behavior that can cross over into work lives elsewhere, can be very compelling.
How did you manage to keep NOLS in Lander? Was there ever an opportunity to go elsewhere, and was that ever seriously considered?
Oh, it was seriously considered. And there were many times, especially in the 80s, where the school looked at moving. And there were good reasons to move. It was easier to travel out of other locations. When Lander went through a big bust in the mid-80s, there was, you know, people were concerned. Board members at the time were concerned that this town was going to close up. And would we be able to recruit and keep staff to meet our many needs at that time? And for me, a big part of it was feeling like if we were going to value wilderness and public lands, we had to invest in places that were connected to that wilderness and public lands. So it's one thing to just have our classes here, which we're always going to be here, but I felt that we needed to ethically position our headquarters here and keep it here.
A couple of things I also want to ask you about. One is you really sort of branched out, and you've had special groups that you've worked with. I remember years ago discussing the astronauts who passed away, that you had actually trained them up there, I think, in Lander, and then you've done that type of thing before. You've had other groups. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe enlighten us and some of maybe the famous people that have come through?
We really came to realize the value of NOLS for intact groups, be it NASA astronauts or Google upper managers or any number of 8 of the top 10 business schools where we work with their students and many others. And it provides an opportunity to tailor the curriculum a bit to their specific needs. And also, if we do it well, and we do it well, it gives us an opportunity to take a group already formed and move them further down that process. And so that is a real change for the school, but it's been very successful. And our growth of working with intact groups has been one of the fastest growing areas at the school over the past decade and a half.
NOLS President John Ganz will be stepping down here at the end of the year. I'm sure we'll bump into you in the backwoods somewhere. John, well, welcome to retirement, and thank you.
Thanks so much, Bob.
For listening to Open Spaces. If you missed any part of this program or would like to find an individual segment, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
There you can link to old shows, stories, sign up for our podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We thank you for your support of Wyoming News, and if you can, please make an end-of-the-year donation at wyomingpublicmedia.org. From all of us in the Wyoming Public Radio newsroom, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.